It's been around roughly 130 years. It's a mature golf market, but it is a very, very influential part of the world in terms of its impact on the game. I mean, think about this. We have in North America, I believe it's roughly 54% of the world's golf courses. We have roughly 60% of the world's golfers. So that's Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Believe it or not, even as much as some people want to be negative on golf and where it's going, we actually have more new golf courses and renovations in the pipeline than anywhere in the world. But think about beyond golf courses and golfers. Think about the influence that comes out of North America in terms of, you know, the elite men's and women's professional tours are based in North America. The biggest, most important events, by and large, whether it's male, female, amateur, professional, are located in North America. Think about the media landscape in North America. Think about the innovation that comes out of clubs, balls, I mean, think Topgolf. Think about what North America has done in terms of innovation with grasses, turf grass research, best practices of golf course. The vast majority of it has come out of North America, if you look back. So as we move forward, and you know, not to mention that, but as we move forward in a mature golf market, that doesn't mean that it's not growing and it won't grow. And I guess, you know, Janine, in terms of state of the game, when we look back, figuring that it is roughly 130 years old, we have seen times of tremendous growth. I mean, you go back in the 1910s, 1920s, golf was growing incredibly rapidly. Then you go back about 10 to 20 years ago and look what golf was doing in our country then. We also have had times when it's retrenched. You go back in the 1930s, 1940s, by far that was the biggest retrenchment we've seen in North America. And in the last, you know, really from 2006 to 2015, we did see some, whether it's participation, the number of golf courses, the equipment side, we saw some retrenchment. But on balance, if you look at things long term, there's every reason in the world to be bullish about the game in North America. There's every reason to be bullish about the game outside of North America. Because in many places in the world, we are seeing growth, particularly in countries that just weren't mature golf markets. But here, if you look at some of the signs in North America, and I frankly, I don't have a lot of data on Canada, but I do know, you know, we get it in the United States, and there are a lot of signs, ladies and gentlemen, that would make you very, I think, happy about where the game is going. Take junior golf, for example. The last couple of years, we're at a high watermark of junior players in this country. It's the one sport that actually, from a participation standpoint of view, is actually growing something. That's a great thing. You look at football, baseball, basketball, soccer, lacrosse, as much as you think they would be growing, they're not growing like golf. Think about from a standpoint of diversity in it. When you go back to what's been really a truism for many years, you look at junior golf. One out of six juniors were girls. Now we're up to one out of three. What's even more amazing is when you only had to go back to 1995, when one out of 17, at least in the United States, were non-Caucasian. We're now one out of three. That has to be good for the future. We have more women playing the game than we ever had. We have more new golfers coming into it. So the people, particularly the media, that want to paint golf as a dying sport, the data just does not back that up. Another thing, golf courses, well, I'll leave it at that. But I guess what I would say in summary is that on balance, we know there's some pressures on the game. We'll talk about those a little bit. But we do think that long term, the game of golf is going to be very good. And when we do have these downturns, you know what it does? It makes the industry think. It makes the industry collaborate. And that's exactly what's been happening in the last decade.
For that, Mike. I know the rest of the world and really all of the golf associations in America are talking right now about how to grow the game. Just talk to us a little bit about the conversations that you're having with the PGA of America, with the PGA Tour right now. Are we collaborating as an industry, or do you think it's more diversified than it's ever been before?
Janine, I would say that, as I just mentioned, one of the byproducts of seeing those big picture participation numbers starting to go down for a while, you're seeing the number of rounds go down, you're seeing forced closures go down, is it almost forces that. And one of the things that was done about 4 or 5 years ago is that the industry, some of the industry leaders like the PGA Tour, PGA of America, LPGA, USGA, and so on, got together and said, you know, and obviously this group has been part of this, is saying, there are just too many programs. Every organization seems to have its own junior program or its own whatever program. So the focus really was, let's look at the ones that are actually making a difference. And let's try to collaborate from an industry standpoint. And when I look back at that time and say, okay, as an example, LPGA, USGA Girls Golf, where it was then, and now it's how it's being supported, you are seeing real results, real impact from that. We are seeing many more females being a part of that, engaged with the game, and that's just one example. So I would say that we are seeing industry collaboration, and the feeling is we're all in this together. And I think that, you know, everybody sitting in here, you are a leader, you are an influencer in your, you know, geographic area, and you are a part of this. In fact, in a lot of ways, you're far more important than what we would do on a national basis, because you are impacting things on a, you know, whether you're a province in Canada or whether you're a state golf association or regional, you do it.
That's exactly right. We talked a little bit about growing the game from a participation level, but we can't ignore the supply side. We can't ignore golf courses. Just tell us a little bit about what you're seeing globally and certainly in North America about golf facilities.
Right. Well, you know, I guess I would start with this, that one of the things that the industry seems to talk about a lot is growth. We want to grow the game. We want more golfers funneled into the siphon, so to speak, and that'll create more avid golfers. And there's a lot of truth to that, and I will tell you, at the USGA, we embrace that, we engage with that, and that has been really a little bit of a shift in the USGA. If you go back 7, 8 years ago, our mission was to preserve, protect, really promote the game of golf. And as some would say years ago at the USGA, you know, whether the game's 50 million people or 50,000, what the USGA's focused on should be the structure of the game. Well, thankfully, that's changed. We still are focused on that, but we really want to get engaged, and we have gotten engaged in industry growth initiatives. But I guess, you know, Janine, to your question, we would say that it's not all about growth of the game. This has to be about the health of the game. And the point being is that if we're bringing a lot of youth into the game, women, you know, people that traditionally haven't played the game of golf, and it's not something they enjoy, they're not going to stick with it. So you can do everything you want, but so you really have to focus on what is the golfer experience. It's not just creating junior golf programs and hoping it sticks, because we've seen that before, where millions will try the game and millions will leave the game. So for us, it's really two parts. It's one, focus on the golf experience. Because if it's good, and you know what the golf experience is not the same. And you know, some of what we think right now is frankly anecdotal. We need more research into what does it mean? How does somebody have a good experience playing? Is it the time it takes to play? Is it 5 hours, and if we shrink that to an hour and a half, is that going to be a better experience? Does an avid golfer who's a retiree have a different type of experience versus a beginner or a junior? Of course they do. And I think that focusing on what the experience should be is important. The other part of this equation, so it's not just the growth, it's not just the golfer experience, but it is the golf facility. And frankly, that's where the USGA, when we look long-term, we will say we have a lot more concerns about the golf course than the growth of the game. Because, again, if the golf courses aren't healthy, you're going to be bringing people into a sport where they're not going to have a chance to play. And by that, let me give you a little stat. You know, it's Joe Pettis was here earlier in the week, and he probably probably talked about that stat about net golf course increase, or in this case, closures. So we've had, in the United States, I don't know the data in Canada, but we've had 11 straight years where we've had actually more golf courses closed than open. So that, I mean, that's a headliner right there. If you're somebody that wants to be negative on golf, that is a headliner. But let's put that in perspective. That ends up being so if you take the high water mark in 2005, we've reduced it almost 6%, not quite 6%. The two decades, and I know you've heard this before, the two decades before that, so 2005 and beyond, we grew 44%. But think about that, 44%. Did we need to grow 44%? Of course not. We didn't grow 44% because there were that many more golfers coming into the game. We grew because of real estate development reasons and others. And what that's done is really gotten supply and demand out of whack. And that is, it's already correcting itself, and I think as Joe probably told you, it will continue to correct itself for the next 5 or 10 years. On a macro basis, that's a good thing. It's hard to see your course down the street close, but some of that is inevitable, and it probably isn't the worst thing, again, from a macro standpoint. But I think the more sobering thing we look at is right now, again, this is U.S. data, it's not North America data, but I suspect it's probably pretty close, is that in the United States right now, 1 out of 4 golf courses is losing money. 1 out of 4. Folks, that's not sustainable. And by the way, when I say sustainable, it's not just from an environmental standpoint. This is a financial standpoint, economic standpoint. So that has to correct itself. Because if it doesn't, think about as we try to grow the game and bringing people into the game, if we have, you know, of the course of the United States or the 15,200 facilities, roughly 3/4 of those are public access. And most of those are actually businesses. And some are municipal owned, but most of those are businesses. And businesses are in business to make money. They're not in business, and they won't stay in business if they lose money. So we have a pressure point there. You've heard us talk about other things, but if you think about these golf courses, I would tell you if you took a survey right now of them, labor is a big issue. It's a very big issue. It's roughly 50% of most golf courses' budget. It's tougher and tougher to find people to work in that industry. Obviously, that area is going to innovate itself. Robotics would be an example of that. But beyond that, you've heard us talk about water before. Folks, this is a real deal. And this isn't just affecting areas like Arizona or California. It's going to affect other areas of North America. You know, since 2005, water costs in the United States, in terms of what we're seeing at golf courses, have gone up 50%. You think revenues have gone up 50% at golf courses? They haven't, and that's one of the reasons hurting. But even more daunting than that, and frankly, when you get to areas like California or the state we're in, they've gone up far more than 50%. We've seen, you know, in the last 5 years, a doubling of water costs in these areas. I mean, I think Kevin Heaney could probably tell you, in Southern California, we now have golf courses that are spending more than $2 million a year for water. You guys know enough about golf courses. That doesn't work. But even more daunting is to look at the future. You know, scientists, these are non-golf people, are predicting that the world by 2030, that's almost 12 years away, is only going to have 70% of the fresh water that it needs. And here closer to home in the U.S., the same scientists are saying the water costs 2017 and 2030, at a minimum, are going to go up fourfold. So sit there and think about that. When I talk about golf courses being more of the concern than growing the game, these are the kind of reasons. And so, but it's not all, you know, and by the way, those water, it's not just about the southwest part of the United States, the west and southwest. I was just talking, I was talking to Bill was at my table last night from Delaware. I was talking to a superintendent not long ago from a course, prominent course in Delaware. 5 years ago, they almost paid nothing for water. They are now spending over $500,000 a year for water. So this is not just, this is hitting everywhere. And I suspect, you know, it's probably going, even in time, going to be an issue in Canada. So it's something that I know we've been focused on, and there's some good stories to tell that in the last decade, with the Golf Course Superintendents Association and USGA, we've put out some best practices. We've worked with the industry. We've seen water, the total water usage down 22% in the last decade. We've seen nutrients usage down over 40%. And that translates into well over $250 million a year in savings. But we actually believe there's a lot more that can be done over the next, you know, really up through 2025. We believe that we can easily get to the point of trimming another 25% off that. But folks, one of the things I know the USGA is involved in our green section and our research, science, and innovation area is trying to say, how do we look at golf courses, not only from a best practices standpoint on maintenance, but how do we begin to shrink the footprint of a golf course? And what's happened over the last century, these footprints have just increased. It's partially, in fact, it's a large part due to what's happened with equipment, but it's not just equipment, it's mentality of golfers. And when I grew up, it used to be irrigate greens, tee grounds, and fairways. Everything else was basically let go. So now we're irrigating roughs. And when you irrigate them, what happens? It grows. They need fertilizer. They need fungicides. And, you know, so we've, in some ways, we've been our own worst enemy in really creating what we think is an experience where you have to have, where you have 130 acres that are perfectly maintained. And I think we feel as an organization, it's going to go back the other way. It's actually starting to, and I know we have developed some technology to help the industry in that regard. So not trying to paint an overly dour picture of it, but I will tell you that when you talk about growing the game, folks, and everybody in this room can help here, don't forget about the golf course, because that's where the pressure points are right now, and they're going to continue to even get stronger in the future.
If you had one perception that you could change about golf facilities and about golf in North America, what would it be?
Well, I think, Janine, what's interesting, over the years, as innovation has gotten better, the golf course maintenance has gotten, in some ways, better. Golf, you know, when you think about how green putting greens are maintained today and just how beautifully they're maintained. You know, as growing up, we didn't have the type of grasses and maintenance equipment that you could get greens near as smooth as you can get them right now. But, you know, we've actually in some ways maybe gone too far on that because greens have gotten so fast that it's probably hurting the game. Golfers have come to expect fast greens. They want fast greens, but fast greens cost more to maintain. Fast greens are more susceptible to disease. Fast greens, in some cases, compromise architectural quality. And fast greens certainly hurt pace of play. So with all those, suddenly we've hurt ourselves. Another perception would be, take that out of fairways. I think I mentioned maybe a couple of years to this group. We've continued to take the heights down in fairways to the point where average golfers right now are having problems getting the ball up. They can't track the ball like a really good or elite player. And, you know, when I joined the USGA, we were mowing fairways at the US Open at a half an inch. Then it got to the point where it was a quarter inch. It doesn't sound like much, but the difference between a half an inch and a quarter inch is one, the ball's sitting up on a nice piece of turf. The other is sitting literally almost against the ground. And, you know, I'm convinced that's why we're seeing more people chilling dead pitch shots. I think with the putting greens, we're seeing, you know, a generation or so ago, we really didn't see many people yipping putts on greens. We're seeing that a lot now, a lot more. And so, in some ways, this innovation has gone too far, and it's probably hurt ourselves. And I would say beyond that, Janine, it's just this expectation that a golf course has to be perfectly managed. And that's cost a lot more money from a maintenance standpoint. And if we can get back to having it a little bit more rustic, then we get off the fairway, it's more natural. So in the summer when it's hot, maybe the rough is a little burned out or dormant, and we just don't use as many resources. And have golfers more accepting of maybe a little bit of more tan look to a golf course instead of a golf course that has to look like Augusta National, because Augusta National is a wonderful place, but that really shouldn't be the North Star for golf courses. And frankly, there's probably too many people in North America that think that that's what it needs to be, including, you know, even how bunkers are maintained, which at one point were supposed to be hazards, and now they have to be a perfect thing that costs a lot of money.
Let's go back to 2014 when you held the U.S. Open at Pinehurst. A lot of controversy about how people felt about how that golf course looked. We're ahead 3 years, almost 3.5 years. Do you think you've changed perceptions of golfers through that event or through any other event that you've seen in the world?
Well, you know, in Pinehurst, that was something that the resort wanted to take it back to its original kind of Donald Ross feel. So they brought in Bill Ford and Crenshaw, and part of that restoration was eliminating the Bermuda grass roughs and going back to really what Pinehurst had once been. They actually went back to single row irrigation, and I forget the stat now, but they're using something like 24% of the water they used to use. And when we had the back-to-back wins of U.S. Open in 2014, the feedback we got from the players, both men and women, was very, very favorable. They loved that those bouncy kind of championship conditions. The feedback we got from around the world, and I can't really say I know what Canada is thinking, but was very favorable. They loved the look at it. The feedback we got from Americans, at best 50-50. Americans were saying, we want to see it lush and green. We want to, and I do think back to this water thing, it's something that we've got to change. All of us have to work on that, and we will eventually. Because if we don't work on it, guess what? Non-golfers are going to have impact on how much water a golf course ends up using. So I think it's in everybody's best interest to do that. Frankly, a dry golf course is much more enjoyable for not only the good player strategically to play, but the recreational golfer can bounce balls and do easy.
Talk a little bit more about that. What's fun golf to you?
Well, I guess for me or for any of us in the room, it's I think it's different people. I think that's one of the things that as we look into the future to the game, and how do we make sure that it's a game that's respectful to the past, but also innovates for the future. I think what we're coming to a realization on is we probably, as an industry, have been a bit too rigid, saying that there's only an 18-hole option, that all the rules of golf have to be exactly the same for all golfers, all the equipment has to be essentially regulated the same way, pace of play works the same way, and I think that we can start to get out of that mindset and say, what is an enjoyable, sustainable experience? I think we're quickly learning with this new generation that they like technology. So how does golf embrace technology? This new generation, many of them saying, I don't have 4 to 5 hours. Yet so many golf courses, particularly, you know, if you go back 5 years ago, that was the only option they had. Either you pay 18 holes or you're not going to play. And I guess you can pay 18 holes and then skip after 6, 7, 9 holes, whatever. But we do think the future is going to be not necessarily just 18 holes or 9 holes. It's a golf experience. I do think you're going to see golf experiences created where you're sitting on a smaller piece of land. Maybe you're using different type of equipment, different distance golf balls. And I think that you can maybe go around and play in an hour. It's going to cost less. Maybe it's more social. I think that's the type of thing where you'll see. So traditional golf, you know, 18-hole golf, 4 1/4-inch holes, you know, current golf ball, I don't think that's going to go away. But I think embracing other types of golf is something that all of us should look at and say, let's be open-minded about.
Yeah, a lot of our data that we have seen really shows that women, juniors, people of all levels, what's really important to them is who they play with and the enjoyment that they have in playing around. As this group holds a lot of competitions, really not only for us as our qualifiers, but also just running state competitions, running regional competitions, what would you encourage them to do to draw in a recreational golfer that maybe doesn't want to compete?
Yeah, Janine, it's a great question. I think that it gets back to, it's incumbent on all of us to think about how do we serve that golfer? How do we serve golf facilities? How do we make sure the experience is good? You know, we kind of related to that topic. USGA and Golf Canada and the Mexican Golf Federation did a golf symposium. So Chris Johnson is somewhere in the room. Hosted us in British Columbia earlier this year, and we were, you know, part of that was really, it's almost a think tank of saying, let's look into the future. And so we did that, and, you know, related to your question, I know from a regulatory standpoint, the USGA is looking at what could help the game in the future relative to golf equipment. You know, there's been a lot of good over the years done in the fact that there is one set of rules. It creates structure for the game, and you can imagine if there were no rules of the game, whether it's playing rules or equipment rules, how chaotic that could be. But at the same time, if we take a step back and we look at other sports, we're really the only sport that has one set of equipment, and that's it. And, you know, I think we wondered, saying, should we be more open-minded to creating maybe conforming equipment for kids? You know, we've all watched a young kid trying to hit a, you know, 1.68-inch diameter golf ball, trying to get up in the air, and how tough that was. Give that same kid, throw down a tennis ball, and watch, and they can actually get the ball up in the air. And you think about other sports, whether it's basketball with the lower hoop, smaller basketball, or tennis, the USTA is, and I know here in the United States, created these smaller rackets that are lighter with a bigger tennis ball that has more felt on it and a smaller golf court. And if you watch kids go out and play tennis now, they actually can play it versus giving them a regular racket, they can't play the game. And so you do wonder if that's something that golf should do. You know, another thing at the Innovation Symposium we talked about is just what is the future of distance? You know, I've said this publicly, but the USGA over the last 120-some years has done a lot of really good things for the game. We've done some things, too, that I sure wish we had a mulligan on, and how we regulated distance, and these were decisions made some, you know, 25 to 40 years ago that are impacting us right now. Is that, you know, I look back and say, what has happened with distance has to be a bad thing for the game. And those of you in here saying, wait a minute, hold on for a second, I don't hit the ball too far. The last thing I want to do is see my golf ball or my distance roll back. But, you know, the fact is, distance is affecting every single one of you because distance affects golf courses. Golf courses have had to expand. When they expand, the cost goes up for the game. Amount of resources go up. If it's a new golf course, you need more acreage. You need more maintenance on how much you're mowing, how much water you're using, how much time it takes to play. And I think that as we look forward on equipment regulation, we aren't looking backwards. We really aren't. And we're not looking at just the male elite game. We're looking at actually all golfers and saying, how does this game need to innovate itself moving forward? And if the footprint is such a big issue, how do we begin to shrink that footprint? And what if we started to give the game options? And at that innovation symposium, we even threw out an idea about what about variable distance golf balls? It sounds crazy when you think about it. But if you really think about, you know, we already bifurcate distance right now with the team grounds you play. I know when I go out and play with my wife, she's oftentimes playing a golf course that's 1,000 to 1,500 yards shorter. Suppose that I was using a shorter golf ball and she was using a current golf ball and we played the same team rounds. What's so wrong with that? You could handicap it accordingly and it would be more social, or she may not want me at her team round. But you know, I think that when you think about what's happened with golf courses and how they've expanded, I'll give you an interesting stat. So we're playing at Shinnecock Hills this coming June, the U.S. Open. It's the fifth U.S. Open we played there. 1896, we played the second U.S. Open there. And for next year, we will be playing at somewhere between 7,400 and 7,500 yards at Shinnecock. Anybody care to guess in 1896 what the total length of Shinnecock was? So I've heard 5,600, 6,200, 67. Answer, 4,400 yards. That was a U.S. Open, folks. And you start to say to yourself, okay, what good came about having to expand the footprint that much? The answer is, the cost went up, takes longer to play, we're using more resources right now, if you're building a golf course, and that's exactly what's happened. We can talk about what's happened, you know, just going back 20 years when you went from steel shafted clubs in Persimmon and Bellotta for the elite players to what you have now. But folks, this has been going on for almost 600 years. And I think that rather than look back and say golf was at its best in 1980, or it was at its best when Bob Jones was playing with Hickories in 1920, or let's go the whole way back and when they were playing with Feathers, who's to say when it was best? So I think that what we need to do is look forward and say, let's consider options for the game and make sure that our game is viable. And by doing that, maybe you don't upset the apple cart so much to say, to my wife, you got to use a reduced distance ball. So I think that those are the kind of things that we are looking very seriously at. And I know for us, I guess that's one of the things that you get to do when you're at a nonprofit and you can look long term, because for profits tend to look what's happening the next quarter. And if you're really long term strategic, you say, what's going to happen in 3 years to 5 years? We actually sit as an organization and say, where is the game going to be in 10 years? Where's it going to be in 25 years? Where might it be in 100 years? Now, nobody has a crystal ball. But when you start to look at some of the data, some of the pressure points that I talked about, if we're not starting to do something now, shame on us. Because these problems will really be on us even tougher in the future. So I would say that, and I've strayed from your question, but it's stuff unusual.
Really strongly about. So let me ask you this. Way that you think about course setup, I think about the Walker Cup and about that really short hole that we had that was under 100 yards. You've done a lot of changes with a lot of U.S. Open golf courses, shorter holes. Tell us a little bit about that and what can you share with this group on course setup and getting people to think about playing differently just based on that one.
Well, I think it strikes us at USGA is, in its very essence, golf is just about how many strokes it takes you to get from the tee ground to get the ball in the hole. Whether a hole is 400 yards or 340 yards, it's still, you're still trying to get that 1.68 inch diameter ball in a 4.25 inch hole. And I think for us, one of the things, and it would be certainly true for you and the championships you run, is that we have so many wonderful golf courses here in the United States and here in North America that when we go to these courses, trying to really showcase the architecture and the different ways maybe to play a hole and to make it more than just a shot-making test, make it a shot-making test, but also make them think through it. And sometimes, having these so-called half-shot holes where it's a really short par 3 or maybe a drivable, and then if you make a drivable par 4, just a short hole where you give more options that you can play it this way or you can play it that way. And same thing with par 5s. It's really interesting because when you get even really good players who think well, when you get them on a golf course and you say, we're giving you options, that does not always mean that it's easier. And sometimes it can even make it harder because you get them thinking and they don't necessarily commit to a shot. So I think that some of the best things in championship golf are not just the long brutal holes, it's those short holes where you've got options and you dangle that carrot and you see some risk. And if they execute, they get rewarded, and if they don't, they get probably penalized. They just play conservatively.
It's fun to watch. Tell us a little bit about governance in the USGA.
set 71 good ones and one bad one. Nobody's ever patting on the back for the 71 good ones you get. And that's what we see in governance. It's expensive, it's fraught with criticism, but it's the right thing for the game. And I think as we've the last several years, really been thinking about governance, not for the elite game, but governance for the masses. And that's really what I would say prompted us to do this rules modernization, saying not enough average golfers, or recreational golfers, know the rules. And I mean, you think about just trying to get a ball back into play. Sometimes you place it, sometimes you replace it. Sometimes you drop it as near as possible. Sometimes you drop it within a club length. Sometimes you drop it within two club lengths. When it hit the ground, there's seven times you have to redrop. People can't figure it out, and you can understand why. In fact, I would venture, yes, everybody in this room knows a hell of a lot about the game of golf, and I promise you, there's nobody in this room that knows every rule. I bet you that there's somebody, a Tom's peg will get stumped. Everybody in this room knows it, it's true. And so I think the whole idea was to modernize these rules and not only make them easier to understand, but easier to apply and hopefully leverage technology to where it is more practical, where you know maybe you're out on the golf course and you pull out your mobile device and you say, relief options in golf from a pond or something like that. Because right now, I mean, when's the last time any of you saw anybody on a golf course pull out a rule book and actually go through it? It doesn't happen. So I think we're just trying to get more, modernize more. With the World Handicap System, you're going to see early this coming year us unveil what that really that code is. And I know there's several people in the room that have been very engaged in this. And it's based on the USGA Handicap System and the USGA Course Rating System. But there are parts of it we've even improved on our own system. And the whole idea, as we know, with handicapping is to allow players of varying abilities to compete on an equitable basis. But you couldn't do that on a global basis because, you know, a 15 handicap in Canada, the U.S. was not the same thing as what you'd say you see in Australia or Japan or the U.K. or Argentina. And so being able to really make this transportable is a very good thing. From a technology standpoint, being able to really collect, you know, data on a national basis, so whether you're in Canada or the U.S., we're going to be able to, through back-end data, be able to collect. And folks, this is data we've never had before. Forget about just the possibilities to monetize it, but just think about how we can make more decisions based on fact rather than just what we think. And so I think that we are very excited about the new handicapping system, and I would say stay tuned. And for those of you who went to Gym Users, I know Steve Edmonds is going to talk more about the details of that.
That's exactly right. Before we open the floor to questions, I'm just going to leave you with this question. What does the future of golf look like for you? What's your perfect vision for the future of golf?
I think it really gets down to those two points I made earlier. A vision would be to increase the number of golfers who feel they have a good experience playing the game. We don't see as many people come in and then end up leaving. And I think that the future vision also would be that we see more sustainable golf courses in different types of golf courses. I don't think that the future probably is not building a lot more 18-hole golf courses on 200 acres. Not to suggest that won't happen more, but I think smaller golf experiences are probably the future.
That's great. We're going to open up the floor to questions. Mark's got the microphone, and we'll have anybody that has a question, please feel free to raise your hand. We'll be happy to answer it. There is everything's on the table. You want to talk about Shinnecock? I know Mike would love to talk about that.
Mike, you clearly identified the issues that we're all facing in our communities with the sustainability of our game, golf courses, those kind of things. It points to both provincial and state and regional, PGA, whatever, to have to be more aggressive in the advocacy role. How do you envision a national body like the USGA? I know you have tax situations that allow you to lobby, but aside from the research and the data how can the USGA help support our efforts in advocacy? How do you envision that kind of opportunity?
Kevin, wonderful question. I think there's a lot of ways. I mean, first of all, making sure, I would say first and foremost, in the United States and in Canada, making sure that non-golfers better understand what golf means to society. That it's not just a rich white man's sport, because the data would back that up. What it really is a huge economic impact. I mean, in the United States, it's $70 million economic impact. It employs roughly 2 million people. And when you start and raises more for charity than all the other sports put together raise, it's got some wonderful attributes in terms of green space, over 2 million acres on a national basis in our country. But I think it goes more than that. When it gets right down to it, it's not just making sure that non-golfers understand how it contributes to society, but it's making sure that people that politicians or regulators understand the decisions they're making and how it impacts the game. And one of the things we're doing is we're putting some pretty good money into a program right now to create standards for each state, working with the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America. And so really making sure that regulators understand their impacts to the game of golf. What golf, for instance, I just told you we've reduced in the last decade water 22%. You got to get a little bit of credit for that because, if all of a sudden in the future that you're creating a baseline based on that point in time, we've already done things. So, Kevin, to me, I think that not only the USGA, but state and regionals can be a big part of educating the non-golfers and educating regulators, state regulators, county regulators, and so on. About what golf does and the impact they can have negatively to the economy, the environment, so on. So, but I know, Kevin, you've been a huge proponent of doing that in Southern California, and it has really shown, you've been ahead of your time relative to other state and regionals because you really had to be, but it's what you've gotten out of that has been terrific.
So Mike, at one of the town hall meetings, I learned that the USGA is taking a new tack with the members program and really kind of moving into a more philanthropic direction. I just recently received in the mail a solicitation, and I'll call it that, to support LPGA USGA Girls Golf and Adaptive Golf. And I just wanted to voice a concern and just get your response. We are very active in that space, raising money for the Evans Scholarship for our foundation, and now it feels like we may need to start to compete at some level with the USGA. So I'd just like you to address that.
Yeah, Ed, happy to. So early next year, we're going to unveil a little bit more that if we as an organization, the USGA, look at our revenue streams, and next year our revenues will be about $225 million. And we say, what are we doing with those resources? How do we get the most impact, good impact on the game? What's the return on investment? You spend a dollar on junior golf, is that better spent there versus governance, versus running a championship, versus a museum, you name it. And so I think we've looked at that saying, if there were more resources going back to the game of golf, actually not to the USGA, but going back directly to the game of golf on things that we know can work, that could be a very good thing. And I think all of you know that, if you say to somebody who loves the game of golf, how do you give back? Right now, there aren't a whole lot of places that financially people can give back. Some people give their time, some people give their first tee, or Evans Caddy Scholarship things, but I think we've looked at that and said, if the game had more resources, not if the USGA had more resources, but if the game had more resources, how could we impact it? And what are the things, what are the programs right now that are making a positive impact in the game? We see LPGA is doing some wonderful things. And so I know we've had discussions with Mike on the LPGA saying, suppose we double the amount that we're giving to that annual. Suppose we quadrupled it. What would it actually do? What could we do? And what I would tell you is that I do think that we will get more into the philanthropic area, and not to compete to you, but to help the game. And, you know, folks, those resources will go back on, it's not going into our coffers. It's going to go back locally into the game. And so I think, you know, it was kind of to Janine's question about the more we partner together, the better we're going to be. This is not our game. It's not your game. It's everyone's game. And so when we look at things that really do positively impact the game, let's support those at a state level, at a regional level, at a provincial level, at a national level. And so that's what it's really about. It was never meant to compete. It was just help the game.
Mike, you addressed water use, and obviously that's a concern here. In the past 30 years, we've reduced water use on golf courses 40% here through reduction of turf. But we're still in the news almost monthly with the oversee. Is there anything going on in turf research that in the southern tier might lead to one grass that could possibly at least take us off the front pages in the fall?
Ed, it's a great question. And the fact that, think about what Arizona's done in that period of time, reducing that by 40%, and you can see it. You look at the old courses in Arizona where you didn't have that, whatever, 90-acre restriction. They from when you're flying in here, they look completely different than the ones where 90 acres. But, you know, Ed, one of the things that I know our green section continually preaches is that overseeding is a bad thing for the game. It's just not a good thing. It's expensive to oversee. You take the golf course out of play when you oversee. And frankly, you don't need to oversee. It gets back to this zest for wanting dark green overwatered golf courses. We've got to get away from that. And so, you know, we've seen courses, probably more in the southeast, get away from overseeing. And you know what they do now? Going into the winter season, they actually allow the Bermuda and the fairways to grow up a little higher because they know once it goes dormant in the winter, it's going to get matted down a little bit, so you create more of the turf in the winter. And then they actually go out and dye it. So from an environmental standpoint, it's perfectly fine. And so resorts that, again, you've got golfers that have this unending thirst for this dark green thing, you can handle it that way. So I think whether you're in Palm Springs, Arizona, the future of it is not overseeding. I think you can get good playing services. We believe you can without the overseeding. You're going to save money, you're going to save resources, and frankly, that's an antiquated way to maintain golf courses.
Mike, the USGA and PGA of America are all focused on growing junior golf and bringing more kids into play with junior league and things like that. But on the flip side with the equipment, obviously we all live in free markets and it's great when we're selling, but we know package trophy ones is $50, PXG irons are a mortgage payment. Does the USGA have a stance on, you know, 10 years from now, what are we going to be paying for equipment and how is that going to affect the game? Because it is too expensive for the casual person to be introduced to the game. After they go through the first tee program, how does that kid keep buying a $450 driver, et cetera?
Yeah, it's really an interesting question. I'm not sure we have a lot of impact on the pricing that's available, but you'd like to think that some of these clubs that don't get used anymore could be recycled, so to speak, and get in the hands of those. I'm out of my element on this one, but listen, we've even talked about that right now, thinking about the golf ball, let's take the distance thing and set it aside. What are some innovations that could happen that would make the game more enjoyable from that standpoint? And, you know, right now, ball equipment manufacturers have the technological ability to put a chip in a golf ball. You see this at Topgolf, where it would actually tell you where that golf ball is. Now, right now, under the rules of golf, you're not allowed to use a golf ball. It doesn't meet the USGA rules of golf that has that technology into it. And that's, think about it, it's a bit of a head scratcher saying, wait a minute. So if that technology exists, we're not going to allow it because we want people to look for golf balls. We want people to lose golf balls. We want people to waste time looking for them. You say to yourself, that's crazy. And now, would that make the golf ball more expensive? It probably would. But the fact that you could use it for longer, you may find out it's 6 feet below a pond that you're not in a pond that you're not willing to. But those are the things I think we're looking at. And listen, even to get more innovative to the game and say, what is the future with equipment? I talked about kids' equipment. I'm sure there's a lot of people in this room that have gone out to play golf before and say, I'm not going to use 14 clubs. When I actually carry my own clubs, I've gotten to the age where I'm not taking 14 anymore. I'll put eight clubs and throw it on my shoulder, and I score just as well with eight clubs. And I have wondered, saying, people use 14 clubs because that's what the limit is on the rules, but maybe we get to a point where we make it more commonplace or more acceptable to go out with less clubs, and less clubs might mean less than that. Equipment manufacturers don't want to hear that, but it is something that we need to think about, what's in the best interest of the game long term, things like that.
Okay, I think we have time for two quick questions. Troy, then Doug.
Good morning, Mike. I had a chance to go to the North American Golf Symposium up in BC, and one of the biggest takeaways I got from that was the USGA resource management tool, being that we have an association-owned golf course. We're able to twist Larry Gabuli's arm into help letting us beta test that, and I really see a huge opportunity with that, with golf associations, state regional golf associations, being able to be at the forefront of that with our facilities, because we certainly see in Washington State a lot of public golf courses that are struggling. They're part of the 1 in 4 golf courses that aren't making money, and to be able to provide that tool with them would really put us in a really good spot. What are the plans in including SRGAs, AGAs, and helping roll that out?
Yeah, Troy, great question. Is the room generally familiar with this resource management app that we've developed? So anyway, it really is kind of in a beta stage right now. It's being used by USGA agronomists working with Venango for a one-on-one site consultation. But the idea is to make this available to the masses. And frankly, we would love to work with state, regional, frankly, provincial golf associations to make this happen, because it's all about collecting data and allowing a golf facility to better understand how they're using resources, where they're spending the money, and frankly, how to manage the future. And it is a really neat application. You literally can take a bunker and say, if that bunker wasn't there, or if we decided to put a bunker there, what would that cost on an annual basis to maintain it? Same thing with size of greens, it's widths of fairway. Taking areas that aren't being used by golfers out of play. If you have a triangle of three holes the way it's routed, does that middle section ever get used? And this resource management app will allow you to look at it, and you may quickly say, we don't need to irrigate that anymore. We don't need to mow it, fertilize it. We can let it go natural, and it'll save us this much annually. So the whole idea with this is that we want to scale this thing. And part of the problem that the USGA's had over the years is that with what we do with best practices with golf courses, unfortunately, it's the haves that have gotten it and not the have-nots. So we haven't focused on that 9-hole golf course in the middle of Iowa that's owned by a mom and pop, so to speak. And so I think that when we think about state regional golf associations here in the U.S., you're really, in so many ways, our delivery mechanism, whether it's governance, but in this case, this could be a wonderful thing to partner to add value to golf facilities in your area. So I think all along we have been thinking that how do we get you engaged? Because that is adding value. And that not only helps a golf facility, but it helps, at the end of it, it's going to help golfers because it's going to reduce cost, and it's just the right thing to do. So thank you for answering.
golf traditional, but be willing to think of different things. The one subject that has been mentioned every single day now is base supply. That's a concern with time and everything else. Yesterday, Mark Russell and John Lillis had the opportunity to talk about course setup. It would seem to me that if you look at what I'm going to call it for the USGA, PGA Tour, PGA America, and the Augusta, that if you guys could come together in one area, it would make and make a statement to golfing population and everything else, and that would be huge. And that would be the speed of the greens. I can only imagine what you're going to face at Shinnecock, especially if it's going to be windy. Certainly Mark Russell and John Lovis talked about the speed of the greens, and we all know watching the Masters every spring what it is like there. Why can't the four of you get together and say, you know what, this is stupid. We are only hurting golf. If you're looking at golf, what is best for golf globally and what is best for everything else, why can't the four of you get together and I'm going to add the RNA to that, and simply say, you know what, we're going to keep greens at 10.5 to 11 and make it reasonable. We're going to be able to use more of the green complexes. We're going to make it, we aren't going to set the bar so high that all these other golf courses feel like if they aren't at 13 that it's ridiculous. I think a lot could be said to the golfing community if you guys would come together, and Mark and John said that the players would go all up in arms on the tour if they were to do that. But if it's truly in the best interest, if everybody in fact-based data shows that speed of the greens is a direct correlation to base of life, why can't the players get together and do something about that?
That's an interesting question. Listen, that almost gets to the point that if you think about running one of your championships, maybe your state amateur or state open, or us with the U.S. Open, Women's Open, you know, what that really gets to is the heart of, you know, championship golf does impact recreational golf. There's no doubt about it. It inspires recreational golf, which is a wonderful thing, but there's also some parts that aren't so good. And frankly, we've talked a little bit internally from time to time, saying one of the problems with our game is that there's this perception, at least in the United States, that hard equals good. No, what equals good is enjoyment of the game. And so every time we set a U.S. Open up, and you think about the width of fairways, the length of rough, the speed of the greens, what used to be the length of fairways, you say, you know, this is really counter to what the game should be long term. So, you know, we have started to do that. I will tell you, the last few years, some of the courses we've gone back to, the greens, simply put, were not as fast as they one day were. We have raised the height of fairway cut. I told this story, I think, to this group before, but when we had the USA Amateur at Marion in 2005 and the Walker Cup, 2009, we had the fairways going at a quarter inch. We played the 2013 U.S. Open, we raised it to a half an inch. And I thought, I know, Mike, you're a member on the board at Marion, and, you know, I won't speak for the membership, but I did hear from several that that it was something. I was a little nervous that the players were going to be up in arms and say, I'm hitting flyers out of the fairway, and they didn't. But what I did know is that according to at least the then president of Marion, superintendent, that the membership actually liked playing it better. And I think that, again, holds true with the speed of greens, with the firmness of golf courses. That, you know, people like, they may not like the tannish look, but they like playing a bouncier golf course. They don't like forced carries. They don't like overly high rough, generally speaking. So all this gets down, and your initial question was about pace of play. You know, what we've learned through a lot of data collection on Research, Science, and Innovation Department, which we started 3 years ago, is that most of the problems around pace of play are not the golfers. It's the golf courses. It's the team grounds people play on. It's the lack of monitoring of pace of play. It's the tee time intervals being too crunched to one another. It's how you set the golf course up with, you know, the force carries or the length of rough or the hole locations or the green speed. So it all gets down to, and I think better practices by owner operators of golf courses have so much to do with what that experience is. So anyway.
All right, I think that takes us to the end of our time. How about a round of applause for Jim?